It is Saturday, November 28th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
And the first half will, or second half, will take your calls with questions and comments of technology. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP.
It's a love-hate relationship. Love your cars, hate it when they break. You'll love the car guys and hate to miss them when Click and Clack give their advice on things automotive. Every Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday morning at 9, right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
You're listening to KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, of course, is Miles Elam, who just spoke. Thank you very much, Miles.
Good to be here.
And we also have Mr. Benjamin Jaffe, and Benjamin Jaffe is joining us via the beautiful tubes of the internet with a crystal tube with lined with a pinstripe of copper, I believe. Welcome, Ben. I think so. Oh, my gosh. Hang on a second. Say that again, would you?
Hello?
Okay, it's going to work in a second. I'm going to hold the table.
There we go.
There you go. How's it going, man?
Okay. I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Pretty good. So we'll start with the geek news today. We're going to go ahead and start with you, Mr. Jaffe, please.
Okay, so there's this satellite. Sorry, there are these two satellites. This mission is called the STEREO mission. This is space news. So NASA's STEREO mission. We have these two satellites that are in orbit around the sun. One of them is close to Earth. One of them is about 90 degrees away relative to the sun, and we have discovered that the sun actually has tsunamis, which is really kind of strange. Like the actually,
I thought a tsunami was like
sun.
A storm with water.
It's not a storm; it's a wave.
Water.
It's a tidal wave.
Yeah, it's a gigantic tidal wave.
It's a plasma tidal wave.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. So back in 1997, that was when we discovered solar tsunamis, but we couldn't be 100% sure that they were actually tsunamis. We thought, oh, well, maybe it's some kind of strange shadow or, you know, something like that. Like, we couldn't really be sure of that. And the main reason is that we only had one point from which we were observing this tsunami, right, the Earth. In this case, however, because we have these two satellites that were both pointing at the sun when this happened, we were able to see in really amazing detail what had actually happened. So basically what happened was the sunspot 11012, for those of us who know the numbers of all the sunspots, exploded. And the two satellites happened to be in the most amazing positions for this to happen. One was straight on to the explosion, and one was exactly 90 degrees off. And so when you look at the little animation on the NASA site, it's just amazing to see. Now, to put this into perspective, the Earth is almost 1,300 kilometers in diameter. Mm-hmm. And this explosion, this tsunami, was 100,000 kilometers high. So, like, wow. 8 or 9 times the diameter of the Earth. That's how high this tsunami was.
So that'd be bigger than tsunamis that are here on Earth.
A little bit bigger, yeah.
Okay. Just making things clear there.
Yes. Also, the tsunami traveled extremely quickly. It traveled at 250 kilometers per second, which in miles per hour is about 560,000 miles per hour.
That's a fast wave.
So this is very unlike tsunamis of the Earth, where, you know, they're not. I mean, they travel fast by our standards here on Earth, but this one,
very cool.
Wow.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, for the update on the sun.
I'm going to post that on the Geek Speak site. Everyone, take a look at this animation. It's really cool.
Cool. Miles, hi.
Hi. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Rupert Murdoch, the owner and operator of News Corp, who owns Fox News and Wall Street Journal, among other outlets, has had it out for Google for some time now. He's wanted to get some money from it and has publicly called out Google for leeching off of his company, saying such things. They should be paying us money. We have this great content, and all they do is just reprint it, and suddenly, you know, they get all this traffic and revenue, and it's off of our stuff. A lot of geeks, such as myself, found this odd because it's trivially simple to get Google not to index your site.
Robots.txt, inside that, I think you'd say deny star.
Right. It's the name of a name of a file is robot.txt. And you put that on your web server and you're done.
Yeah. There's, and if you put, well, if you put inside there deny space star, I think is the syntax, but it could be star.
But you could also deny just from Google. You could say just Google is not allowed to, and everyone else is allowed.
And that basically means every search engine that plays by the rules looks for that file on the server and says
what's
in there.
Which Google does. Yeah. Google does play by the rules.
Sees what's in there and follows the instructions on that. And if you don't have one of those, it assumes that you're okay with taking everything. And if you put one in, it will do exactly what it says.
Yeah. So it seemed a bit disingenuous when he's – yes, he's not probably not a geek, but – he employs quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Because all of the sites that I mentioned have websites
so
that are relatively...
So clearly someone told him that they could turn off Google from doing this. Why isn't he doing that?
But it looks like he wants a bid for money, which, fair enough.
He's a businessman.
A lot of people are.
A lot of people,
you know, going for some
You'd like some money.
Yeah, sure.
If you want to give Miles money, let me know. We'll pick you up with an address.
Now, what makes this interesting, though, is Google... in talks with News Corp have been very vehement that they're not going to pay any money for this.
Yeah.
And so talks broke down, and that's probably when Murdoch became public with this. Microsoft then stepped in, and News Corp talked with Microsoft over Microsoft paying some money so it can be listed on Bing, their rival search engine.
Yeah, but doesn't Bing list it anyway?
Yes, except Microsoft is willing to do that. The idea being that they would have this,
if they'll pull off of Google, then they'll
They restrict access from Google and then give it to Bing for that fee. Now, this doesn't work with just News Corp sites because obviously that isn't the bulk of news sites that are out there. So what Murdoch has done is solicit all of the other news organizations to do
he's
the same
a media
to pull
campaign
out
to have those companies be interested in doing what he's doing.
Right to form this united front. In other words, it's a play against the prisoner dilemma. It's a philosophical construct where if everyone stays quiet or everyone does the same thing, it's the best result. But everyone has this push to work in their own interests.
Right.
Even though it could be bad for the whole.
So the general idea would be get all the news organizations out there to agree to turn the robot.txt file on for Google. Google would no longer have any searching capability on most news. And their news system would fail.
Right, more specifically,
and then Microsoft would still have it available, right. And Microsoft would be kicking some money back to all those corporations.
Right. More specifically, they would say that no one can index them except for Bing, for example, Microsoft
Possibly.
Search engine,
right.
That type of thing, and say if you want to index it, pay us this money and we'll open it up for you. You know, we'll make it.
I could see this
allowable.
As a strategy to get Google to penny up a bit, but I can't imagine it actually being successful. The idea of taking that kind of risk with your revenue stream because Murdoch says it's a good idea. I don't know. It seems like a kind of risky maneuver.
Yeah, because there's currently a lot of revenue that comes from the traffic that Google generates to the different news outlets.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's to a variety of news outlets, not just to a specific few.
Right.
So,
but if you're the 10 news outlets that say, no, forget it, Murdoch, we're going to stay with Google, we're going to stay open completely to anybody, you're still going to be listed everywhere. And there's no loss to you except that you're not going to get the revenue kickback from Bing or from Microsoft.
Well, the idea is they end up being walled gardens.
Yeah.
They're trying to reclaim what they had before, which is you go for the newspaper, you grab that newspaper, and
it's definitely an interesting thing to follow. I can't imagine it being as functional as Murdoch wants it to be. I just don't think the net works that way.
I certainly hope it doesn't.
The model is the search engine idea is to find stuff. That's all it's really for. And then Google happens to be making money off of the search engine. I don't know. I mean, I think it's got to stay open. It's got to stay that any search engine can offer. I mean, if Bing,
well, it doesn't got to. Through the .com boom, we know Bing, that it wasn't quite the utopia that many people were playing
Microsoft
it out to be.
Could do a thing with Murdoch and any other corporation where if their search results were the top results by chance, then they wouldn't put ads on their site. Like, they could theoretically set up some other model, or they take you to the news story that's Murdoch's by a paid cost. You know, there's other ways to do the search engine business, but it just kind of breaks it if you start saying only these people can start indexing me. You basically start separating the net out into different places. I don't know. Thank you for following it. I think it's an interesting story. But
yeah, I haven't. In this particular instance, I don't have anything against Mr. Murdoch, but yeah. I sincerely hope that he fails.
In other incidents, you do, though. All right. Thank you very much, Miles, for the update on the Murdoch-Microsoft deal. Ben, what else is going on in the galaxy?
Oh, I have so much space.
Hang on just a second. I'm sorry. We're having problems with my connectors of my laptop, so I have to hold them for a second.
No.
Go ahead, Ben.
All right. Am I here?
You are.
Fantastic. Because I can hear myself. I don't know about you guys. But a couple months ago, I talked about a technology, actually a game, if you want to call it that, online called Galaxy Zoo. And that's where the game shows you different images of real galaxies that have been observed. And you have to classify them as, you know, is this, for example, is the spiraling? Is it spiraling to the right? Is it
right.
Spiraling to the left?
Right.
And of course, the idea is that humans are very, very good at pattern recognition, and computers are okay at it, but they're not nearly as good as humans are at this point, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, get a whole bunch of people to play this game, and you suddenly have all of this data, and then you can kind of weed out the outliers and get some really good classification of galaxies. Automatically, without you having to do it. You just have everyone on the internet do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have released another one, and this is Galactic Collisions. So this is Galaxy Zoo 2, and you guys should all check it out if you feel so inclined. It's one of those games that's fun, but it's also very useful, right? And so what it does is it shows the different players images of colliding galaxies, of real colliding galaxies that have been imaged, and then asks them to match them to simulations. And by doing this, they can kind of figure out how these galaxies actually merged by comparing them to the different simulations. So pretty simple concept, but a lot of fun, definitely. And definitely in that realm of useful, well, I shouldn't say useful games because I'll get flack from anyone who games, but they're especially useful because all of this information can be used in research as well. So,
okay, thank you.
Yeah,
have you played it?
I have. Yeah, I was just playing it a couple minutes ago.
Cool. Thanks.
It's a little Java applet.
That's a Galaxy game. It's up on our website, geekspeak.org.
Yes, indeed.
Miles, talk to me about sample rates and what that means.
A sampling rate in an audio file refers to the number of times that you're taking a view of an audio waveform. An analogy would be if you had a flip book, a flip animation book, where you flip through the pages and it shows the cartoon animation going through. The fewer pages you have, or the more pages you have, and especially if you're flipping them very quickly, the more smooth the animation is. That's equivalent of what the sampling rate is like in an audio file, is that if you take a smaller and smaller time slice and take it more often, you're going to have a much closer rendition of the original audio than if you only sampled it a few times per second.
And with the flipbook analogy, the human eye is not nearly as good at detecting sample rate as the ear. So like for humans, pretty much 24 frames, more like 50 frames per second, is pretty like amazing. You can't really tell the difference between 50 frames a second and real life. 24 even we're used to in film, you can tell the difference, but it's so used to it. We're so used to this point, it seems fluid. But in sound, you have a really short sample rate and you don't get good quality audio at all. Now, the other thing that music has, that online digital files, is that we actually compress them quite a bit. And compression, can you explain that to me, audio compression?
Audio compression usually through Fourier transforms are actually used for the conversion from analog to digital, but they are a way of saying we have these repeating patterns, we have these patterns we've seen before, let's, instead of recording each of them exactly as they are, try to play around with it a little bit so that it takes up less space.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one way of thinking of compression, very rudimentary just to get things across, would be sheet music. Sheet music is a representation of the music. This idea that you're pretty close to what it is. It's not an exact representation because every performance is going to be a little bit different in the case of a sheet music. But
right.
It's still something that's much more compact, much easier to carry around than a grand piano or an orchestra set.
Right.
You know, as you're going through town to town. So it's sacrificing a little bit of fidelity or sacrificing some fidelity so that you can have it in a smaller space, make it more portable.
Okay. So you sacrifice. And we hear this by the kind of sample rate we're talking – I mean the encryption rate we're talking about is like if you have a 128 kilobit MP3 file versus 196 kilobit MP3 file. That's the kind of words that we use. The GeekSpeak podcast is 64 kilobits mono, so it's not stereo. And that works pretty well for voice. For music, you need a little bit higher, 128. I normally, whenever I rip CDs, I go 192 kilobit per second MP3 file. So what's the study say about that? Is that pretty good?
Well, as it turns out, it is. Although there are some audiophiles out there that would disagree.
What's an audiophile?
An audiophile is someone who it's the audio equivalent or music listening equivalent of a foodie is to food.
Mm-hmm.
It's someone that it's not just something that you enjoy. It's something that is consuming to your personality. It is something that you will only accept perfection. It can only get better. You can always tweak it to get a little bit better, and you're always driven to tweak it to get a little bit better.
Gotcha.
And
perfectionist.
Yes. Now, it turns out that most people can't hear the difference between 192 kilobits per second and uncompressed audio. You
really?
Just can't hear it. This is coming on the heels of some other news saying that people can't taste more than four tastes in,
right.
in a glass of wine, even
yeah.
though they say they can, because you're biologically not – human beings are biologically not capable of doing so.
I hear that, and yet four seems pretty small. Like, have you ever tasted stuff and you're like, this tastes like – you know, there's molasses in it and probably something lemony and cinnamon. You know,
they were talking about wine, not necessarily all tastes in general.
But they're talking about all tastes in general when they talk about that study, because the wine is just the assignment of one of the flavors. So people say, we can taste nuttiness and there's a little bit of cheese, and I would say there's a prairie scent to it, you know, that kind of structure that winey would say. Oh, good.
Well,
winey. Any case, with audiophiles, what you're saying is that they took a whole bunch of people. They threw them in a room with really good sound systems or really
good
headphones.
Yeah, some of them were just
played
general
them,
people.
And they couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah, and this is not a huge sampling size. This was maybe 50 people. But mm-hmm. they would take – they had some people that were just off the street. They had other people that were admitted audiophiles. They really cared. They were saying, I can absolutely tell the difference here. And of these people, only one of them was able to consistently tell the difference between – the compressed audio, the 192 kilobit per second MP3 file, and a FLAC file, an uncompressed mm-hmm. audio file. And that person was someone who normally listened to her music relatively low volume. So when the headphones are on, it's not bleeding out, or not
right.
drowning out everything in the outside world. She actually had it pretty low, and she never attended loud rock concerts.
So it's from lack of stress on the ear.
Right.
Ah, interesting.
Those of you who have not followed this particular woman's example, by all rights, cannot hear the difference between a compressed audio file and an uncompressed audio file, even though you may believe it vehemently and will probably email us talking about how we're absolutely wrong and the study is wrong.
And the way you can test this should be pretty easy. Get the two files, put a WAV file, put a MP3 file, 192 kilobits on your machine, the same music, and then have someone else switch it back and forth and have them write down stuff and make sure they can't see you.
But actually, you should also make sure it's a sample of something that you haven't maybe some music you haven't heard before, preferably maybe a live recording with a high quality.
It has to be really high quality.
It has to be very high quality. So some typical CDs are made for, you know, some house party music. Something like that would not be a good example. You need to find something that has a lot of
depth
and complexity.
Because you definitely wouldn't be able to hear the difference.
Right, some depth, complexity, and something
that
normally
sounds very
good.
I was just saying, listen to your music, because if you're listening to your music and you can't tell the difference between the two, why bother? You know, compress it. Save some space.
But you also have to not know which sample is coming up. That's why the double-blind study comes in handy, is that you can't know which sample it is when you're deciding which one sounds better, because there's confirmation bias, always. If you have the two samples next to each other and you go, okay, here's the uncompressed one, you listen to it, yeah, I can hear the problem. Then you have the or rather you have the compressed one and say, yeah, I can hear the problem. Then you come up with the FLAC file, the uncompressed file, and go, yeah, see, that one was better than the last one. Your data is completely messed up. You
right.
can't do that. You have to not know which one's being played.
Hence the double-blind study.
Double-blind study also says the person who's giving you the right. sample can't know either.
Well, there's one way to do it between just two people doing it. One person sits in one room, the other person sits in the other room, and you both write down on a piece of paper when you switch, what you switch. So they can't see each other. I mean, it's kind of cheating, but you can do some things where you're not giving each other clues.
Right. But that's just a good single-blind study.
Right. Right.
Right.
Let's move on, I guess. Right?
God, I wish we should do a show on double-blind studies.
We said that 2 weeks ago.
I know, but we need to do it.
Then book it, man. Book it. Book it, Dano. Is that how it works? All right.
I actually had that problem with blinding myself in confirmation bias. When the Beatles' Love album came out, the remixed one, or the remastered one, excuse me, and I was listening to it, and I was like, wow, this sounds so much better. But in reality, I just hadn't really listened with good headphones really closely to the recordings that I had on my computer. And when I listened to them, I could tell the difference a little bit when I actually tried to blind myself. Those are only somewhat successful, but I found that for the most part it was mostly confirmation bias.
Yeah,
that's another thing. If you have iPhones and just the stock iPod buds, and that's the way you listen to your music, especially if you're listening on the bus or walking around,
it don't matter what you
do. 92 kilobits per second audio would probably be just fine. I seriously doubt you'll be able to hear the difference, and you'll be able to get more music on your iPod than you would normally.
That's a good point.
That's true. I've started just compressing things MP3 at 168 or 192 because that's totally good enough for me. I mean,
well, according to the study, you can't hear any better than 192, even though you may protest.
Yeah. Oh, no, I don't protest anymore. I would have protested maybe a year ago, and then I discovered that I'm just a silly tofu consistency brain like everyone else, and I'm...
Wow, you anyway. Listened so much in the last year?
I know.
What was the... All right.
I finally grew up in that sense, right?
All right. I want to mention that next week you can hear us and see us live. That's right. We're going to be downtown Santa Cruz in the parade, the holiday parade. That's December 5th, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning. The parade goes till noon. We'll be going till 11, just like we normally do. We'll be in the parade, on the floats, sitting there trying to do a show live, traveling. Now, this is on Pacific Avenue in downtown Santa Cruz, and we're still trying to figure out the technical particulars. We're going to have a phone for backup. We're going to have some networked kind of traffic. But any geeks out there that have good ideas on how to deliver high bandwidth Wi-Fi to a float parade in downtown Santa Cruz, you give us a ring. Give us a jingle, okay? You probably have my information. I'm Lyle at GeekSpeak. And I'd love to get a little bit of assistance on that. The premier thing is we're probably going to have two different ways of getting data. And I'd like to have something that goes in the between, kind of like a proxy, that determines which path to take so that we can keep a stream going through Skype, because that's how we're planning on connecting the station. So, in any case, for the non-geeks out there, come downtown Santa Cruz next week, 10 o'clock, for the holiday parade. We'll be through the parade at some point. And if you want to ask us a question, you can run up to the truck, and we'll throw you a mic, and you can ask away. So that's next week, December 5th, on GeekSpeak, live in person, downtown Santa Cruz. Miles, I think you're reading something again for us, but I'll do the first one, okay? GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam. And we also, through the wonders of the pipes of the internet, we have Ben Jaffe. Miles?
KUSP and the Alliance for Human Rights co-sponsor the second annual Human Rights Fair, celebrating the 61st anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Friday, December 4th through Sunday, December 6th. Events include an art show, artists look at human rights, a human rights performance gala, human rights fair with booths, food, information, speakers, and entertainers, and a human rights fair in Spanish. Information on times and locations is available at humanrightsscc.org.
The podcast for this week that I'm going to recommend is for adults only, and it is the Savage Love podcast. I'll have it up on the website. I think it's just, yeah, Savage Love podcast. It's talking very, very openly and freely about sex and sexuality, and only adults, I would assume. But I've liked it a lot. He's very open. He takes calls. It's all via podcast. He also has a column. In any case, I recommend the Savage Love podcast for adults that are interested in sexuality. All right. Moving on. Let's do one more. Well, let's invite people to call in. What the heck, right? We can do that. Phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Miles?
Before we go on, I actually am curious about Ben's next story. We'll cut him off.
Oh, we'll cover it.
Okay.
We cut him off?
Yeah, we were going to him, and then we got sidetracked and commented on the previous story.
Oh, that's right. We need to do we'll do that in just a second. You get to find out in just a moment what Ben is actually going to say. It's just going to be seconds from now. But first, let me invite you again to call us with any questions you have about technology. We will definitely answer them. We won't necessarily answer your questions correctly, but we'll give it our best shot. The phone numbers are 476-2800. And if you don't listen or know well enough, you probably won't know the difference if we do it correctly or not. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Okay, Ben, what's going on with Saturn?
First I want to ask, have either of you guys seen the Northern Lights on Earth?
Not in person, unfortunately.
Fortunately, I have not either, but I've heard that they're beautiful. Apparently, Saturn has them too. This I didn't know until today. We actually discovered this years ago. I can't remember. I can't find the year, but we discovered this a couple of years ago, and we've observed Saturn's northern lights in the ultraviolet and the infrared before, but this marks the first time we've seen the visible light spectrum, the northern lights in the visible light spectrum, and this is the Cassini probe, and it's been observing Saturn and all of its natural satellites, because Saturn's a really cool place and all the moons it has and everything. And it just turned a camera on it, and it found it saw the auroras, the northern lights of Saturn. A couple of really interesting things about the northern lights of Saturn. On Earth, first of all, the northern lights are because charged particles from the magnetosphere. They go into the planet's upper atmosphere and they cause the atmosphere to glow. And then the path that these particles take, that's what we perceive as the northern lights. That's the glowing. On Earth, they're not very high. They're 100 to 500 kilometers above the surface. And that's mainly because Earth has a lot of oxygen and nitrogen. But because Saturn's atmosphere is mainly made of hydrogen, so it goes much further out. And as a result, the aurora are much taller. They're actually 1,200 kilometers above the edge of the northern hemisphere. And as most of my news stories today have been visual, you should also go and check out that on the website. These are really cool looking. They've superimposed this like a wireframe of the planet, so you can see where the planet is because it's pretty dark. And then you just see these kind of snaking northern lights above Saturn. It's really neat. So that's it. Saturn has northern lights.
Thank you, Ben.
So who's going to go there with me?
Oh, I'll go there. You get the spacecraft together and make sure that we don't get radiated too badly. And I want
Do
food
you have
on the way there
blankets?
And back. Yeah, sure. I'll bring blankets.
I mean, I've just got one comforter, but...
Yeah, you take everything else. I'll bring blankets.
Okay, we'll take a field trip.
All right, sounds good. All right, let's go ahead and take a phone call. From Santa Cruz, we have Karen. Karen, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Karen. Oh, yeah, that's probably better if I do this. Karen, hi, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
What's your call today about?
Well, we bought a used computer, and it didn't come with any documentation or software, okay. Like installation software. And a message comes on the screen that it is a pirated version of Vista.
Sure.
And I don't know a lot about dealing with all the operating systems, but it sounded like it was maybe a good idea to change over to Windows 7.
How new of a machine is this? Does it have the stats to handle Windows 7?
I ran a There was some program that you could run to see if it would handle it, and it does.
Okay.
And it's got a 64-bit.
Okay, yeah. So it's a pretty relative. You know, it's a used machine. It's a relatively new machine.
And so you want to get with XP. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking I don't even want to bother learning Vista. I'd rather go to Windows 7.
That makes sense.
Okay, so I was hoping I could do an upgrade to Windows 7, but because this message comes on the screen that it's a pirated version, I thought maybe I should get just a full, brand new Windows 7 operating the software.
I have a tendency to believe that if you're buying something from them, an upgrade, does anyone know the difference in price from an upgrade version for a full version of 7?
Well, I found the upgrade is around $105, and then on Amazon I found somebody selling the full version for like $116, which was...
So you decided to go for that?
Well, I bought it, but I have not opened it yet because it says it's a system builder pack.
Oh, it's like an OEM?
OEM, yeah. And like I said, I don't know what I'm getting into here, but it's
okay.
Over my head.
Well, so an OEM install just means... it might not have all the driver support. Miles, you want to help?
Well,
with this?
OEM is it's licensed differently. The idea is that when you buy it, it can only be used on the system that it's installed on. It's usually for new computers, and the idea is it's non-transferable.
Right? Okay. Don't they do that with software restrictions too? Don't they normally compile it correctly for a certain software and a certain hardware? Or is it? I mean, what's the what's the downside of having OEM disk if it's not for the computer?
OEM, you also don't get. The idea is you don't get support from Microsoft, you get it from the OEM vendor.
Yeah.
So I don't know how Microsoft would deal with you if you ever had a problem, if you called them up for support. I don't know many people who do because it's
a pain.
Kind of a pain.
But if you did, for example, they'd say, well, where'd you buy the computer from? And you're like, well, I bought it online, and well, what is it? It's a Dell. Oh, contact Dell. Right? And then even though you don't necessarily have a Dell OS installed on it.
Right.
Is it a major manufactured box? Does it have like a model number or something?
It's made by Microsoft.
It's a Microsoft box?
Yeah. It says Microsoft all over it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It will be
Microsoft. No, not the software. I'm sorry about the computer.
Oh, the computer? HP? I'm sorry.
It's an HP.
HP.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
and it
HP
says
has
on the box that I would also need to get an OEM pre-installation kit, and it sounds like I can go to Microsoft.
No, but see, you're getting into this space that is pretty geeky, right? You're basically installing it like
a manufacturer
install. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of downside on doing it this way, except your time and effort, right? I wouldn't be surprised if an upgrade worked. I don't think that Microsoft's going to restrict and really make sure that your copy is completely legal to upgrade. They want you to pay the money. That's why they give that warning saying this is pirated, because they want to say, pay us, please.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if they will say, you know, yeah, we'll upgrade you. What I would do, and this is a perfect case, I would get on the phone with Microsoft or get on an email with Microsoft and say, look, I have a machine that I bought. I want to have a legal copy. How do I do it? And they will tell you because they want to sell you an OS.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
I think that's the best way to go.
All right. Because, I don't have a product key for the Vista.
Right, exactly.
Even prove to them that I have it.
That's okay. Call them and tell them what happened.
Okay.
Like you're willing to fork down $100 for them for their OS that, you know, maybe they'll have a program. Sometimes they have a program specifically for that, right? They're giving you warnings because they want a trustworthy customer to contact them, right? They want someone who's not actually hacking to say, hey, I got a problem here, and they will help you through it, you know, and say, look, you know, I bought the machine, I thought it was going to work, and I'm really frustrated, and I want to have the right OS, and I think I'm going to go to 7. This person, Microsoft likes the customer like you, you know, they're going to like you. Just be really honest with them. There's no skin off your nose. You know, they might say, no, you've got to go out to the store and buy the package deal. And if you can get it for not that much money, more money than the OEM disk you bought online, I'd return the OEM disk and get the full package because it's probably not worth your time to figure out how to be an OEM.
Yeah, so you're suggesting what I did was I actually did buy the upgrade version, which I also have not opened because then I started realizing if it's talking about if I have a pirated version of this, I was afraid I was going to open up the upgrade.
I think it's a perfect case to get on the phone. If you've already bought the upgrade and you're now going, hey, there's a problem, I'm concerned, they will tell you whether it'll work or not.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't want to hurt you as a customer. They want to help you.
Oh, I appreciate your help, and it's great you're here.
All right. Thanks for calling
in. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That was Karin from Santa Cruz. We're now going to go to La Selva Beach with Julius. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, this is Julius from L.A.
Oh, you're from L.A. I'm sorry. I thought it was Silver Beach. Calling, I guess you're listening via the internet. So what's your question today?
Well, first I'd like to make a couple comments based on things you said. You were talking about the rings of Saturn. Don't you think that those prove that UFO people have been to our solar system? Because
no, I don't. What's your next question?
I don't believe those rings could have been formed naturally. Anyway, you were talking about sex, a podcast about sex.
Mm.
You know, I like sex and money. I'm making a reference.
You know what? I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. Sorry. Thank you very much for calling. You're welcome to call us or email us later if you'd like. I cut off Ben instead of the phone call. That was silly. All right, so let's go ahead and take the next call. Dan from San Jose. Dan, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello. Welcome to GeekSpeak, Dan. What's your question?
Yeah, I've been following the Rupert Murdoch thing with some interest as well and trying to figure out where's the value add that we can find so that we can actually afford real journalism.
Exactly.
I mean, we're looking at things like the Washington Post has now closed its New York and L.A. bureaus. If it's reached the level that the Washington Post and the New York Times are cutting in, I'm deeply concerned that we're surrendering control over information because we dilute it so much with so many little sources, nobody vets anything. So we've got to have some way, you know, everybody likes the information is for free model, but the bad news is crappy information is free and good quality, well-vetted information usually involves paying somebody to do the work.
And you're willing to pay it if you could just assure that it would be good quality.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's why I buy the New York Times or the or the San Jose Mercury News, for that matter, or the New Yorker magazine.
And the truth is that the real model on how we're going to pay for this new type of journalism, how we're going to make sure people do good in-depth research, it doesn't exist exactly. It's still completely unknown. We're on a raft here, right? And I have a lot of optimism about it. I think we're going to figure out a solution that's going to work really well. Miles, you had some ideas?
Yeah, I was actually reading some stories recently about how the profit margins for newspapers actually is worse than it used to be, but isn't as bad as
we think.
I mean, many businesses would actually kill for their current margins. And I wonder about times in the past especially when those big names were just starting out, where they didn't have quite the pull that they did, but they still tried to do good journalism.
Right.
You know, Washington Post 100 years ago trying to do good, or 84, I forget how old they are.
That general concept I'm assuming, Julius, you're talking about is there's, you know, 6 million websites out there that are posting news information or ideas and journalistic kind of thoughts without any kind of real research, real making phone calls and going and interviewing people. There's not the real like journalism on the foot except for when those people get paid. And the models right now for those people to get paid are slim and far between. And this is a giant topic, which I'm quite interested in, but not extremely educated in. Miles?
Now I'm also curious, as few and far between, and I hate to toot everyone our own horn, but NPR, PBS.
They're there.
They are there and they get a lot of their funds from people saying, hey, this is a good quality, I'm going to give you some money.
Right, and NPR has been cutting their news bureaus for the same reason, because not enough of us have been doing that.
Fair enough.
I mean, I'm a member of KQED. I just happened to be driving down in Carmel and heard your show today over the air. But the problem is that the number of people who are willing to do that doesn't appear to be sufficient to keep the value equation going.
I hear the concern. I think what's going to happen, I mean, kind of my optimistic perspective on technology and the human race is that at some point we're going to figure out a way to pay people for really good stories. So the worth of a story is based off of a kind of peer review in the scenario, and the person gets paid for that out of the cut of the whatever revenue stream there is, marketing, whatever. And we start losing the conglomeration and we have much more independent free agents. But that is just one scenario that might not happen.
If that model were going to work, I would think that Fox News would not be watched by nearly as many people as it is.
That's the negative side of all of it, yeah.
I do have a question for the listener. This is an area where I don't know. I'm just curious, Julius, what your thoughts are.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dan. This is Dan.
Sorry, Dan. What your thoughts are on this. Right now, a lot of these news organizations are getting a huge amount of traffic from Google, that people are putting in a search on the news, and it's driving traffic to them, and presumably by extension their ad revenue. And so what I'm wondering is if they lose that transmission from Google because they're getting a payout, you know, or something like that, then I'm curious as to where the win scenario is.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm hoping to find myself. And at the moment, one of my problems is I don't see it. Right. In that right now, what's happening, if you look at major newspapers like the San Francisco Chronicle, which is whose newsroom has also been hit very hard, the click value of a website doesn't come close to what they used to get out of classified advertising, which got taken by Craigslist, or automobile sales, which is now all on autotrader.com, or even furniture sales. I mean, the advertising model that drove news worked great when they were the aggregator. Now that they're not the aggregator, the traffic isn't high enough for them to get the ad revenue that way.
Well, let me just push one more podcast, because I think we're going to go on to the show. But do listen to, if you're interested in this topic, listen to On the Media. I believe it's...
Oh, it's great. Great show.
Great show. That's one of the podcasts I listen to. They cover this kind of topic about media and the effect of the new tech on media and how we're coping with it and what's happening. Great.
So much as I don't like Rupert Murdoch, I've got to admit I think it's good that somebody's at least trying to play some different roles on the model.
Yeah, well, it does need to be stretched, right? It needs to be fractured a bit and figured out. And he's doing that to some degree. I agree. Thank you, Dan, for the call.
Thank you for taking the call.
Bye-bye. Well, let's go ahead and take another call, I think. Unless we got a news story we got to get to. Geeks? No? Okay, I'll take Charles from Seattle. Charles, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question today?
Oh, well, I don't have a question. I was listening to some of the questions about licensing, and I wanted to affirm that if you buy a system builder license, I think the biggest differential between a retail license is getting free support, right? The retail license gets 90 days free support and unlimited setup and activation support.
That's the retail version.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Also, my suggestion to that caller would be, they should contact Microsoft if they've got a warning that says it's a non-genuine version of Vista.
Yeah.
There's a number of reasons that it could come up with that and still be a genuine copy, and
right.
They might be able to send them to technical support and actually just get it fixed.
Right, and I think she wants to go to 7 anyway because she's going from XP, and she might as well skip Vista. But I agree. I kind of recommend just talk to Microsoft. At this point, they don't want to hurt her, right? She wants to pay some money, so they want to take that money, and they want to make sure she's a happy customer. But you really think the big difference between an OEM install and a retail install is the support?
Absolutely.
Right.
The unlimited setup and activation support, specifically setup support, I think is the real differentiator there.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for the call, the clarity.
You got it.
Take care.
Right, and something for the earlier caller's problem with it is she bought this used computer without any installation disk that went along with it.
Right.
So that ends up nullifying, even if you had a legitimate copy, that ends up nullifying a lot of your rights with regard to the upgrade process.
Right, the
it's
only
it's
other
unfortunate.
Thing you could think is that HP, who has a serial number on that box, knows how they sold it and potentially keeps record of what OS was installed, including the key. So it's possible that OS is actually locked down to that piece of hardware. But that would be a conversation with HP, and they might bounce you back to Microsoft. It just becomes a problem.
Right.
All right. Let's go ahead and cover into the news story while we wait for calls. If you'd like to call us with questions and comments about technology, please do so. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Ben, are you still with us?
I am.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I think it's – is it your turn to do news?
No, you just covered
Northern
Lights.
That's right. Miles?
Yeah, it's Miles' turn.
Miles, what's going on with new power plant?
The world's first osmotic power plant was
what is that
announced? What you don't know?
No. Okay, moving on. No.
Right,
go ahead, tell
right
us.
We hear about wind power, solar power. We never osmotic. What is that supposed to mean?
Is that like meditation power?
Right now, we use reverse osmosis, put an electrical charge in a membrane to separate out the salt from salt water to make fresh water, and it requires a great deal of energy. It's very energy intensive. Well, it turns out if you go the other direction of mixing fresh water with salt water, you actually can generate power.
Okay, so wherever a river is running into an ocean, you could generate power.
Right, which comes in very handy for a country like Norway with its fjords and like it has a
with
huge
its melting
amount
ice caps.
Of it has a huge amount of rivers and tributaries emptying out into a huge coastline relative to the size of the country.
So how would you do that? What do these things look like? Big tubes?
From what I understand, yes. And
like
you have the seawater and the freshwater in separate chambers, and those chambers are divided by a membrane. And salt molecules pull the fresh water through the membrane, increasing the pressure on the seawater chamber. And then that pressure is used to power a turbine.
Wow. That's kind of cool. So would it have to be like a motor in this situation? You'd have to like vac, you know, pull out the liquid and then have it empty and then put the liquid in so the pressure density is the same and then it would move and that would be kind of like a giant cylinder and then you do it again? Because if you just have a constant pressure, you can't really generate stuff with that. You have to get to something that moves, I'm assuming. I don't think you can do a constant pressure generation, right? You've got to move something. Anyway, very cool. I'd love to see how the engine works. The general concept here is that, it's hard to describe the chemistry of why osmosis works, actually. But basically, it is hard to explain. I'm not even sure if I know it. See, normally I have the answers to these things. Ben, you were in college recently.
The company behind it, StatCraft, has stated that their technology – bear in mind this is a press release, so take with a grain of salt. But they say that it has has the potential to create enough electricity for about half the European Union's total power production. So somewhere in the range of 1,600 to 1,700 terawatt hours.
If you covered every single surface of the perimeter of the...
Well, the thing is that you want to get fresh water from rivers, but in general, the natural state of things is that rivers flow out to the sea.
Yeah.
That's what you're supposed to do. So this is actually not, as far as energy production goes, this is not interrupting things very much.
Well, assuming you don't take the entire river flow, right?
Well, even if you're taking the entire river flow, the water is still ending up...
It's not
the
water,
ocean.
It's the animal life in the water and the other material in the water that is going to be filtered. I mean, the clean water on one side of the membrane and the other side, you've removed a whole bunch of sediment. I mean, you're going to have a lot of issues with this system.
Experiment.
So is this just a test run or are they actually in some kind of pseudo-production?
They have a prototype going. So it is a test run, but it's an operational prototype.
That's awesome. Very cool idea. The general idea is that two fluids with different types of concentrations like to flow between each other and actually have the same level of concentration. So if you have a very salty water on one side of a membrane where molecules can go, the water molecules will go into – this is why. The molecules will go into the liquid with the salt, will bond with the extra salt particles that are in there, and then they'll be too large to go on the other side. So just about flow. It's nothing that complicated. I think that's how it works, but I'm not a chemist. All right, let's go on to – thank you very much, Miles, for that. Ben, what's going on in space today? I know that every story you've covered is about that, but what the heck? Keep going.
It's amazing. I've only found space stories this week for some reason. I found this – actually, this is a really cool idea that I was reading this column on. Basically, we have a huge problem. We've got all of these pieces of space junk. Actually, there are 18,000 pieces of space junk that are the size of a basketball or larger orbiting the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine this poses a problem, you know, like launching spaceships or even putting things into orbit. And we've got tons of things into orbit as well. The International Space Station has had to worry about this problem several times.
Because the stuff up there ends up going at very different speeds. So it's not just the fact that it's a basketball, but it's a basketball going relative to your speed, something like Mach 3.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
That's
so
a pass.
You might be orbiting the Earth in one direction, but then a piece of space junk might be orbiting the opposite direction.
Which and would be much faster than Mach 3.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a head-on collision on the freeway versus, you know, looking at the person cruising next to you, you know?
Let me just make one comment, Miles. Can you stop using Mach as a reference speed in space?
Okay, fine.
There's no air for sound to travel. Thank you. Anyway, moving on, Ben.
I wasn't going to say anything, Lyle. Thank you.
I had to.
Anyway, so obviously this is a huge problem, but how on earth do you deal with that? How in orbit do you deal with that? Thanks for the catch. It's kind of like, you know, all of the plastic in the oceans. How do you collect up all of those very relatively small pieces of plastic relative to the entire ocean? You know, same
I'll bite. How do you do it in space, Ben?
One big catcher's mitt.
Or basketball hoops over trash cans. How are they doing it?
Sorry, Ben. Good point.
Actually, someone has proposed what they're calling a space garbage scow.
Cool.
And basically you put this garbage scow with this huge net into orbit into high Earth orbit. And then of all of the pieces that we're tracking, you just solve this really complex math problem. Basically, you end up at the end with you put this garbage scow in a position where it will intercept, say, a piece of space garbage. And then its interaction with that space garbage, because it'll have a slightly different
it's high-speed collision with it, yes.
Well, no. The idea is, you know, of course, you try and figure out a way to keep them from colliding at high speeds, because then you'll tear the net.
Oh, this is cool.
And
so,
you'll also lose all of this energy, too.
So you basically pick pieces of equipment that you can take because the velocity is in such the parameters that the net won't rip. And then that changes your velocity slightly, and then another piece will be available. So it's kind of like the – what's that calculation problem, the computer science problem, the shortest distance between every city? Kind of thing?
Yeah.
It's the traveling salesman program.
The traveling salesman program, but a lot more complicated because every time your velocity is modified. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's a really neat idea. I love it. Because once you get it up there, then you'll only need very, very minimal interaction with your scow and maybe the rockets on the scow to reposition it. But ideally, most of the time, you won't even need that because you'll have solved this math problem. So its interaction with all the space junk that it captures will prime it for the next collision.
You've got to have some jets on this thing, because just imagine it. Just think of it this way. It's a pool table of 18,000 balls, and you're going to throw, and all of them are moving, and there's no friction, so they move forever, and they all collide with each other. Actually, it's pretty spacey, so there's no collisions, but not very many collisions. And then you're just going to throw, you're just going to do one thing perfectly. You're going to throw something, and eventually it'll hit everything, and everything will stop. Like, that's the complexity we're talking about. It's astronomically insane. I wish we had some way of programming and processing large amounts of data that, computers could solve that. Cool.
Now, they did a really quick back-of-the-envelope calculation and found that if the scow orbits every 90 minutes and takes an average of a dozen orbits to set up the capture of each next piece, then that turns out to be about 36.9 years, which they note is about the same amount of time it took us to get all of that stuff up in the first place.
So most of that's our stuff?
Oh, yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I would love to cover this wonderful story of Miles's about cool bags, and you've got a minute.
Okay. Cooling servers in data centers is a major problem. So you have these huge air conditioning systems, and you're blowing through there. When we went over to GNI, where our site is hosted, it was cold in there.
Yeah,
like you had to put on a jacket because you're trying to keep things cooler. And as they put more servers in, we noticed it started getting progressively warmer and warmer. This, a UK company, Isotope, has a technology where they put the servers into bags, and you're filling those bags with a liquid, but a non-conductive liquid.
Yeah, I'd assume.
Right. And the idea is that you're pumping this fluid through just the bags, not through the whole data center, just around the components that are necessary on that server.
That is very cool. You can learn more about that on geekspeak.org. Geekspeak on KOSP, supported by Whole Foods Market, featuring fresh farm-raised Thanksgiving turkeys, free of antibiotics or added injections. Whole Foods Market in Capitola in Santa Cruz on SoCal Avenue and in Monterey's Del Monte Shopping Center. This is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. The Geeks Today were Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. Geekspeak on KSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Miles, another 10 seconds on that story?
Sure. The idea is that it costs basically one-tenth of what it would cost otherwise.
Very cool. Thank you. For Geekspeak and for KSP, I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be downtown next week on Pacific Avenue for Geekspeak Live.